Welcome to episode 3 of the Marvel Us podcast. I'm Tom Laurie with my sister,
Leona Laurie.
And today, for our third episode, we watched Blade 2 from 2002, directed by Guillermo del Toro, written by David S. Goyer, and starring Wesley Snipes.
I totally forgot that Guillermo del Toro directed it. And now, Ron Perlman and the way that the bald vampire's face is open makes a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, did you forget that Guillermo del Toro being the director would mean this would be kind of a gross horror movie in a lot of ways?
No, but I mean, am I wrong to think that Guillermo del Toro means Ron Perlman?
No, that's exactly right. Like, Ron Perlman and the main bald vampire guy, like super vampire. I don't know. Do they ever reapers?
Yeah, reapers.
Is that what they call them? Both of them have been in multiple del Toro movies. I think they're both in the second Hellboy movie together. Yeah, Ron Perlman, guaranteed weird body horror, very likely. That was the thing that surprised me the most about this. The only thing I remembered about this movie going in from the first time I saw it was that fight with the ninjas in his factory of ambiguous location. First movie is a shampoo factory in probably L.A. This one, we're fairly certain the whole thing's in Prague, so I guess he brought all of his factory accoutrements with him to a new factory in Prague.
I think you better do a quick recap of the plot before we start getting detailed.
That's something I appreciated
quick,
this time around.
Like a
right,
minute.
This one had way less plot to worry about. It's pretty much like Aliens, but vampires. So Blade goes to Prague to track down Whistler, who he's been tracking since the end of Blade 1. And he finds him in like a blood tank, and he turns him, he got turned into a vampire, Blade turns him back into a human, and then as this is going on, there is this dude with a double hinged jaw that like splits at the chin, and like a tentacle comes out of his mouth, and he feeds on humans and vampires. So the vampires are like, oh, there's this new type of vampire that we don't know how to deal with, so our crack team of Blade hunters need to team up with Blade to hunt the super vampires, and, you know, gross stuff and double crosses ensue.
Things that you forgot to mention in that recap, Norman Reedus is Blade's sidekick, then also everybody ultimately is taking orders in one way, shape, or form from the Master. I don't know what his name is in this, but you know how super old vampire, for some reason you're all waxy and slimy? Is that true in every vampire program? Like the oldest vampires are waxy and slimy?
It is based on something. I can't remember. I can't remember what the specific basis is, but there was like some, you know, popular vampire thing where it was like, oh, the super old vampire has skin like marble. Yeah. So that's what they're trying to emulate there. And I mean, he kind of looked like he was made of plastic, kind of looked like he was made with marble, especially when he died. But yeah, it's very similar to Aliens in some unexpected ways. Like, I forgot how much of, cause the first Blade is so much of an action movie. It's just like an action movie that happens to have vampires, but this one was much more of a horror movie, with the vampires being much more monstrous and lots of, you know, creatures chasing people through dark hallways and sewers and whatnot.
Ugh. I don't know. I don't really watch horror movies. I can't comment on how similar or dissimilar it is to them. I would say that it was a gore fest that I had to cover my eyes a lot of times, because that whole effect where the Reaper vampires lower head through neck and chest, and like sometimes most of their body would gape open and stuff would come out of it that had teeth. Like, I don't know. I don't need to see that again in my dreams. Mm-hmm. It was nasty.
It was very gross. And also there was like, they go to the vampire nightclub again, because you always gotta. But this one, like, they're going there, assuming the Reapers would go there because, you know, why not,
food,
I guess.
Food party.
But there were lots of, like, coverage shots of, like, vampires doing gross, weird vampire things, like, cutting their bodies open to do, like, weird... Body I don't know if it was, like, body mod stuff or, like, sexual stuff or what, but lots of exposed...
it was so underdeveloped,
bone
though.
And innard and whatnot.
Like, okay, so the nightclub in the first one is called the Bloodbath. It's at the back of a slaughterhouse, and that's it. Like, that's its theme. Its theme is blood, and it's cleverly hidden. This one, in Prague, maybe, like, where we think we spent the whole movie... I guess it's in some sort of mansion. It's called House of Pain. Nobody jumps. When you walk in, there's like this sterile room full of guards standing next to the kind of torture equipment that some austere Nazi usually takes out of a briefcase in something like this. Then you go from there into a room full of people dancing to era-appropriate electronic music, including the Crystal Method and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Only instead of wearing white like they did in the last one, everybody's wearing black and red at this club. Vampires like to color coordinate for their nightclubs, as far as I can tell.
Well, it's a different culture.
But then, like, okay, so and then there's all the body mod stuff. So you could say, oh, well, the theme of this one is torture and sadomasochism for pleasure and all of this. But then they're like... They show that all the Reaper vampires are in a pit full of spikes underneath the dance floor that they never do anything with. And then all of the team that's there hunting the Reapers is, like, spreading out through the rest of the building that turns out to be some sort of gothic mansion where most of the building is abandoned and there's, like, a creepy kitchen full of things that can hurt you and catwalks. I mean, it's like, it reminded me of those sketches from old Saturday Night Live where there'd be, like, bag full of glass as a toy for kids where it's like, hey vampires, why don't we have a club where we make one really high-tech security room full of torture devices and the whole rest of it is gonna kill us.
Yeah, it was, because when they go in the club, they're like, oh, this place is, you know, light tight and whatever, like, it's all, you know, vampire safe so that they can party all night or whatever, but the further they go in, as they branch out through this the mansion portion, it's like, no, this doesn't look well secured at all. Like, it seems like there's light coming in through these windows already. It was very, very odd how disjointed most of that environment was from the dance floor portion. And, yeah, like, it kind of felt like two portions of a movie stitched together. Like, there was supposed to be something, some sort of transitional stage in between going to the club and going to this mansion. And then the mansion just became the club at some point.
Yeah, I thought this movie was terrible. I gotta tell you, I felt this way during the first one, too, where I had to keep reminding myself to stay awake, that we were gonna talk about it later, and that I had to watch the whole thing and pay attention to it. Otherwise, I think I would have conked out, because here are some of the things that I noticed during it. Like, I'm just gonna randomly put these in a pile here. So Donnie Yen, most recently being the Force is with him in Rogue One, and Norman Reedus, and Kris Kristofferson, who else do we recognize?
The guy from Death in Paradise?
Oh yeah. I wish I could think of his name.
His character's name is Assad in this.
Assad, who his day job is being on Death in Paradise on the BBC, and he's been on that show forever now. Anyway, none of them looked younger in this. And, Danny John Jules. That's not a compliment. That's not me saying, boy, these guys haven't aged a day since 2002. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is, did Norman Reedus ever look young? Has he ever washed his hair? Because he's got huge bags under his eyes, and his hair looks like exactly as greasy, mullety as it does now. And this is 15 years ago that he's looking like this. And that's how I felt about, well, I guess Donnie Yen looked a little younger, but I don't know. That was one thing. And then there's like this whole thing where Kris Kristofferson, like in the other movie, he shot himself in the head, but off screen.
Mm-hmm.
So what they say is he turned into a vampire after that, and then the vampires have been keeping him alive in a blood vat that they move from city to city around the world, ?
Something to do with goading Blade, but yeah, it seems impossibly contrived. Like, the thing I was thinking about during this movie was how, like, you think you know what you want, and then when someone tries to fulfill those desires, maybe it isn't actually what you wanted. Because, like, I was thinking about some of our gripes from the first movie, where it's like, you know, why is there all of this ancient vampire culture in America? So then we get to see the ancient, like, vampire culture in Europe, but it turns out to be, you know, pretty boring and nothing. And also, and in conjunction with delivering on that, you lose all the interesting aspects of having, you know, vampire culture in America. Instead, it's just this, you know, single... It's a very compact movie. That was something I found interesting, was that it pretty much all takes place in this nightclub slash mansion until the final standoff in their weird vampire laboratory. And I was not expecting that. Like, I thought there would be more locations than there.
They do go to the question mark factory.
Yeah, but that's it.
All purpose.
Like, you never really get factory. A sense for where the factory is, other than that it's somewhere. And it's also a much, like, aside from that awful ninja fight, that ninja fight really stood out.
Oh my god.
Because, I mean, that one and the final main fight with, you remember the main vampire monster dude's name?
Mardok? I don't know, something like that. Mordok? Mordo?
That's not it. I forgot my notes. But
oh, look at it. Nomak.
Nomak. They use a lot of the CG in the fighting, in the major fights, where it doesn't look as bad as I remembered it looking, but it also doesn't look good. Like, in my memory, it was like sub-video game of that era quality CG, but seeing it again, it was like, this looks era appropriate, but it still looks bad. It still is way too, and I mean, it's not as bad as the blood monster stuff from the end of the first movie, but it's still not good, and they use it way too much in the fights. That was something I read, was that there were four fight choreographers, like two professional guys, and Donnie Yen, and Wesley Snipes, and like the quote I read tried to play it up like, oh, it was this playful competition, but in the end result, it kind of seems like they just couldn't mm-hmm. cobble together.
That sounds like an Alan Smithy fight coordinator situation. Like,
they couldn't, cobble together a cohesive aesthetic for the fights, because there were definitely some fights where it was like, oh man, that looks so much like fights I've seen in other Donnie Yen movies. Like, there's one where it's in the final fight where Blade dislocates Nomak. Is that what his name is?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Really?
Yes, jeez. That is his name. Whew. It's Nomak.
He dislocates Nomak's arm, and then Nomak turns the tables, and while he has Blade pinned, he does, like, this, like, swirly move with his arm and relocates it. And that's like a real kung fu movie kind of thing that I've seen before, but most of it was quick cuts and bad CG. And
I thought the fights were a mess. Like, I don't know if I'm spoiled by modern standards, but then I was thinking, well, what year did Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon come out? Like, I know this is post-Matrix.
Yeah,
like,
Crouching Tiger came out in 99.
Yeah, so I was thinking of, like, other movies that I've seen that predate this or that are contemporaries of this where the fighting looks tight, but, like, for me, so many of the moves that they were doing, it was like, oh, you know what? I can't dance. I'm not a dancer. But I can tell, after all of the television I've watched, the difference between somebody who's really tight and doing it right on those dance TV shows mm-hmm. and the people who are not. And that's what these fights looked like, where they looked like they were so floppy on their feet. Like, they weren't landing anything clean.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, especially Wesley Snipes, he was just... his body was such a mess during the fights where, like, none of his landings and follow through were clean. That was very distracting to me, where I was like, I couldn't take any of it seriously. Like, even last time, you know, when I was saying I appreciate the diversity in casting, this time I was like, I'm trying so hard to appreciate here, and I am not succeeding. I am not succeeding in appreciating. I only am criticizing.
Well, there's even less to appreciate because, you know, they sacrifice the multicultural aspects of L.A., the two black leads, the Chinatown setting. Like, instead, it's a bunch of white European people.
Well, they've got a black guy and a Chinese guy on the main team.
Yeah, but...
And, I mean, it's not as good. They go down
pretty quick.
It's
not as good. That was like, yeah. Donnie Yen was the biggest disappointment, because Donnie Yen's so great, and then he dies like such a sucker, like, off screen.
Yeah, off screen. I was like, is that silhouette him? And yet you confirmed that it was. It was so unremarkable.
And he had such a cool look, too, with, like, his partial samurai armor and eyeliner.
Yeah.
I thought, man, that Donnie Yen, he's going to do something cool at some point. But no, because...
He never did.
The twist of this movie is the super vampires are immune to garlic and silver, which are, like, the main go-tos. Otherwise, they, you know, just make vampires explode like most things do. And, oh, yeah, they're immune to the anticoagulant as well. So, like... All of the tricks from the previous movie have no effect. Sunlight's the only thing that gets it done.
Sunlight's the only thing that gets it done. And so they establish that pretty early in the movie. And they're like, here are some flashlights to attach to your guns. If you point them at them, they'll explode. And then they use that so sparsely through the whole rest of it where they're like, look, I know I could kill this with a flashlight. But instead, I'm going to do kung fu for a half an hour, use 4,000 bullets, and then ultimately stab him with my sword before letting sunlight touch him. It was like, it was so overkill contrived. It made no sense in a way that was distracting. It wasn't good enough to be that bad.
Like, the thing about that was that, like, oh, I get that they made this crack squad of vampires, so of course these vampires would be really cautious and afraid of using sunlight. Because that's the one thing I really appreciated about this compared to the first movie was that they actually treated UV light as, like, a serious thing. Like, there's a part where Ron Perlman puts his gloved hand into the sunlight and you see smoke coming out from under the glove. And it's
from the glove.
Well, but like
it's not
sunlight.
Like you can just put on some heavy sunscreen and go down to the beach
but
for
the
sunrise.
Yeah, they never even attempt that level of disregard for sunlight. Like Blade being a sunwalker and sunlight and UV light being super scary and dangerous to all of these vampires is a very concretely held concept throughout the movie. And I appreciate that compared to the last movie where it's just like, oh, I'm just going to...
Good catch.
Put on some fucking sunscreen and go
They
out.
Make a sunscreen joke during this.
They do.
This.
Like, yeah. And but I'm glad they never treat that as if it's, like, actually a good idea.
Well, let me talk about, like, maybe my biggest pet peeve with this, both of these movies, is that I still don't feel like they've established anything to suggest, to explain to us why it's bad to be a vampire. Like... There's the whole thing about Blade suppressing his thirst again, and he's basically ready to kill Kris Kristofferson because he's a vampire. So he shoots him up with the cure, and he's like, the sun is going to touch you in the morning, whether you're cured or not. And, you know, it's like a serious thing that he's considering killing his father figure, who I guess he's been trying to rescue for 2 years. But he says to him, if there's any of you in there, I want you to know this. Like, there's nothing to suggest that the person's soul or personality leaves with their vampirism. Mm-hmm. Like, Nyssa, the kind of love interest, but, like, the female protagonist in this anyway, who is a pureblood born vampire, seems like a pretty reasonable and nice person. All of the vampires have dimension, like, as much dimension as any of the human characters do. Like, there's nothing to suggest that... The vampirism makes their original self disappear. The only hint of that in the last one was when his mom kept trying to seduce him. But, you know, like in Buffy, when Angel loses his soul and the average vampire is operating with soul, I guess they get kind of loose on that eventually too. But like, anyway, let's not go there. Well, I don't get it.
No,
I don't get why everybody's so worked
and
up
like,
about vampirism.
Regardless of the consistency in Buffy, the, you know, explanation at its core is that a person who is a vampire is not the same person anymore. Becoming a vampire is a demon inhabiting that person's body now. So that's like a different being. But in this, yeah, it just seems like it's the same person, but now you want to drink some blood. Or if you take Blade's serum, you don't. Which is something else they never really touch on is his girlfriend / doctor from the previous movie. If she developed, like... I guess she developed a better serum because the one time we see him take the serum, he doesn't do the whole full body contortion writhing thing that he did in the last movie where he took his serum. Is just kind of like, ooh, but this is tough.
There's that point where Nyssa's like, you're the same as us. I don't know why you suppress your thirst. And he's like, And then he puts down the serum and doesn't take it.
That's all. Yeah, I forgot about that. And that was weird.
Yeah. And then, I don't know.
He did feed her his blood, though, although she did not erotically drink it to near fatal proportion.
No, that is, you know, a sexy trope for vampires. But what I was like, she has fangs. You don't need to slit your wrist to put it up to her mouth for her to suckle. Well, she's so weak. Oh, my Lord. Shame on you, this movie. I feel like I started making a pile of the things I noticed, and then I got distracted and went away.
That happens. I've already been there. I like the concept. Oh, yeah, that was something I was trying to get at, was, so the vampires are all super afraid of UV light. UV light is the only viable weapon. The big reveal at the end is that the marble-skinned super Dracula vampire father was doing vampire science to create these Reapers, and I don't know if he turned his son into one or if he bred a son as one. It's ambiguous.
He bred a son as one.
But why would he be, like, if he's so obvious, like, the way he's so, nobody knows about him and he's so cast out and he's such a monster, but he still has this family crest ring, like, it seems like there's a gap there between this person being treated as a son and nobody ever knowing about him and him suddenly appearing out of nowhere to do
mischief. He's like one of them attic sons. You know how sometimes in a movie they're like, oh yeah, this is my secret other kid that I keep in a weird dark closet for reasons that don't make sense. That's what this guy is. Attic son.
Okay.
Yeah.
Either way, the whole point was we've succeeded so far in making sort of a vampire that's immune to silver and garlic. Our next leap will be sunlight. But, you know, they know this guy's immune to silver and garlic. Sunlight's the only thing that works. We have thousands of human, like, military gear bodyguard dudes manning our complexes. Why is your crack team of vampire hunters vampires? Why wouldn't you get a bunch of human soldier dudes or whatever who would be immune to sunlight and could just use sunlight as their primary weapon?
Or any single character in the whole thing pointing one of those flashlights at him.
Well, I mean, yes, but I get why, at least why these vampires would be reluctant to use the flashlights willy-nilly, but I don't know why they use vampires in the first place. What if it
points back at me accidentally?
Because it's, yeah.
I know.
It's also not like the vampires are like, oh, we're like so fucking good at all this stuff that most of them get killed pretty easily, except for Ron Perlman.
Yeah, that guy's durable. Did you notice when they get to vampire compound headquarters for the big showdown at the end that it's like 1,000 guards, spotlights, security everywhere, and then Nordok, or whatever his name is just sort of crouching Namek there in the middle of it without being hidden, and no one is noticing him? He's like ultra conspicuous.
Yeah, no, it was a very silly thing.
Supposed to be sneaking.
But they don't know he's coming.
Ron Perlman did not look younger in this either.
What? Ron Perlman
he's doesn't ageless. Really
ever look young. Yeah.
He's ageless.
I did like his wraparound mustache.
Oh my gosh. His hair was so weird.
The wildest choice in the movie. His mustache goes, like, connects to his sideburns and goes over his ears and then around the back crown of his bald skull head, and it's really good. And everyone wears sunglasses all the time. I kind of like that. The sunglasses were very stupid, but I did like that every vampire everywhere always was wearing sunglasses.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many fashion things that I haven't given any thought to for a long time until we've watched these movies. And it's funny because Buffy is another one of those things where when you watch it now, the fashion is one of the things that really hasn't aged well through a lot of it. It's just, I mean, not that it's bad looking to me, but it's so of its moment. and both of these Blade movies. Maybe it's a vampire thing where they're like, we have to be super hip, really on trend, in a way that is going to time capsule this movie forever. So that, like, what I was really noticing in this, and I noticed it in the last one, but this one sort of drove it home for me, is Velvet was a really big deal for a while in the late 90s and seeping into the early 2000s.
Like, and hip, but not forward-looking.
Yeah, like, oh my gosh, there was so much Velvet, and there was a lot of... I mean, I guess there wasn't a lot, objectively, a lot of Velvet in this movie, but compared to how anybody would use Velvet today, for example... More than that. Yeah, more than, conspicuously more.
More velvet lining Blade's trench coat than in most people's wardrobes.
Well, and for crying out loud, let's talk about this whole... So, you're an ancient vampire. Here's how you're going to look. You're waxy of skin. You're kind of slimy looking, probably. And for reasons that just are never made clear, you're going to wear some kind of robey thing. And in this guy's case, I can't remember his name. I'm calling him the Master. The Master's wearing a robe that is at least twice as long as he is, so that everywhere he goes, he has this dramatic train, which is extremely impractical. He's on his way to get on a helicopter. He's wearing this majestic, flowing velvet train, and he doesn't get to the helicopter. But in that moment when I saw where he was heading, I was like, how is he going to get on a helicopter in that? That thing is going to blow right up over his head and get tangled up in the rotors.
Probably not a question he was asking himself when he got dressed. I mean, how often is that guy going on a helicopter to anywhere?
Well, and the helicopter, we should watch it again. No, I don't want to. It's too bad. Like
a big stone drawbridge door to his room. I don't think he gets around much.
Ugh. Yeah, he totally was the Master.
Well, I mean, the Master is, he's a Dracula.
Yeah. Well, Dracula came out in what? The Bram Stoker's Dracula came out in 1982, I think. So, it's been since 1992 since I saw that movie, but I'm sure that there's vampires who have that ancient waxy look in that too.
I mean, I have.
I guess that goes all the way back to Nosferatu in the 20s or earlier.
I think that's a well-established trope of waxy,
really bat boy from that
white man who wears flowing robes.
Do you look like that bat boy from the Weekly World News?
Yeah. Well, what do you think vampires are?
Bat boys. Yes. All grown up.
Batmans.
Oh, so much bad.
Something else I kind of liked about it was the idea that killing Namek would finish it off. Like, that's something they don't really touch on in the first... Like, the first one, you just gotta kill the bad guy because he's a bad guy. But killing this dude who's spreading this new vampire virus, that kind of goes back to the old sort of ideas of killing Dracula to end the vampire's curse.
Yeah. So, okay, here's some things. Chris Christopherson.
He got a paycheck.
So he turned into a vampire, and then he got cured, but he still has a bum leg. They're in Prague, maybe, but he's able to retrieve his wedding ring from where he taped it to the back of a scale in the factory, like a scale that you stand on to see how much you weigh.
Well, they brought Blade's car, so it seems like they just kind of brought everything.
But, like, why was his wedding ring taped to that scale? Is that from the first movie?
No,
so weird.
It's a very weird detail that doesn't seem to connect to anything.
At the end, there's so many moments where he's useless in this, where, like, he's a human, he has a flashlight, there's all these scenes where Blade is like in the ninja fight, he's taken on two ninjas at the same time using knives in front of a wall of lights, and Norman Reedus and Chris Christopherson are at the other end of the room, out of frame, but presumably just sort of standing there watching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got guns, they've got UV lights, they've got all this stuff, and they're just like, oh, what's going on over there? And then that seems to be how Chris Christopherson participates in most of the fights through the whole thing, is standing around looking at what's going on over there. And then at the very end, he has this moment where he uses the gun like a pistol, you know, not a machine gun, not a rocket launcher, to shoot a bunch of the fetuses off of the pillar of genetically engineered vampire babies. Mm-hmm. And then he looks satisfied. But he does not shoot all of them.
I mean, he shoots enough. You gotta figure.
He does not bring sunlight into the room. He doesn't do anything to give it a conclusive ending there.
Maybe just making a point. Ugh. Yeah, no. His inclusion from top to bottom was very puzzling in that he brings nothing to the story and they don't develop his character. Like, he adds nothing. It's really odd, especially when they also add Norman Reedus, who's just taking his role pretty much, like, story-wise, but then has, like, a turncoat moment at the very end and then immediately is exploded.
Yeah, Blade is like, I already knew that you were a turncoat and I'm exploding you right now. Like, there's...
I enjoyed that.
You don't... I mean, yeah,
not the turncoat part, because it was like, this is super obvious and who gives a shit either way, but very good exploding.
He was... He was not likable. His name is Scud, and he watches the Powerpuff Girls 100% of the time.
They wanted him to watch Speed Racer, but they couldn't get the license for it.
Is that true?
So that's why they went with Powerpuff Girls. So the vampires in this, you got your normal vampires and your new vampires, the Reapers, which split at the chin and have like a tentacle that comes out of their mouth. And that is based on Polish vampire myths in which their vampires pretty much, you know, have some sort of mouth appendage that does the deed instead of fangs. Damaskinos, that's the Dracula's name.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Curry was their original hopeful actor for that, but he didn't do it.
He would have been amazing because he just is.
I also realized that David Goyer wrote The Crow, which, like, man, did that guy have an aesthetic in the 90s and early 2000s. And not a great one? I don't know. Maybe the aesthetic's the only good thing and everything else about it is not. It did pretty well, $150 million global opening weekend. This had the least interesting trivia, least interesting production stories, like Del Toro wanting to treat sunlight like an actual threat, and the conflicts between the fight choreographers were pretty much the only tidbits I came away from.
Is Wesley Snipes the owner of this? Like, was he the driving
force? I believe he was a producer, but, like, I don't know what you mean by driving force.
Like, okay, so I feel like if this was a Guillermo del Toro movie, without there being some other hand that had a lot of sway in how things went, it would have been good. But well, it looked like it had the feeling of too many cooks in the kitchen.
I know Del Toro has said that, like, he's always bummed out by the criticism of the fight scenes because they had to farm out that CG. Like, that wasn't something they could do in-house at that point. So, like, a lot of that stuff was out of his hands. And also that he was, like, really into the first movie. Like, he watched, in preparation for making this, he watched all of the dailies from the first movie. And, there are even flashbacks of scenes from the first movie. So, like, I think, if anything, maybe he was a little too reverent of the source material he was working from in...
That is crazy.
...in trying to keep some of that style or not goodness.
Because I felt like there were some moments that were really evocative of things that you see from him later. Like, there's one point where one of the team members gets turned into a Reaper, and as he's turning, everybody sort of, like, tag team kills him. And Ron Perlman's contribution is to slice part of his head off. And he does it at, like, a diagonal so that you get a gory shot of the inside of his head with brain and everything. But then Blade exposes him to sunlight. He explodes. But the little piece of his head that got cut off does not explode, and it has one of his eyes on it, and it's just laying on the floor looking around and blinking,
mm-hmm.
but then they don't do anything with it.
No.
So they just leave it there, but, like, that felt like Guillermo del Toro to me. Also about Ron Perlman, I never have a problem with him. You know, like, other people seeing them in something like this where I'm like, this is so boring, you can't act, how did this happen, who's responsible for this mess? Like, I think a lot of things like that when I'm feeling very critical. Except for about Ron Perlman. With him, I'm like, this is weird, and he is in weird stuff. This makes sense. I looked on IMDb to see how close to each other Le City des Enfants Perdus, the City of Lost Children, and this movie were, thinking they might have been back-to-back. They were not. That movie came out in 1995, and I think that was the first time I saw him in something where I was like, this movie is so weird, I don't know what to do with it. But I mean, that was after he was in Beauty and the Beast on TV. Mm-hmm. And I think he was in the other one from the same French director's The Butcher Shop movie. I don't know, maybe you don't know any of these French movies from the 90s that I'm referencing.
But I'm familiar with City of Lost Children. I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it. I don't know what Butcher Shop movie you're referring to.
I'm going to find out what it's called, but if you have something else you want to say,
well, I remember City of Lost Children was one of those boxes I'd always see in the Blockbuster as a child and think, man, this is some creepy box art.
I saw it in the theater. I saw it in the theater because it came out during a time where I could see any movie I wanted to at the local art house movie theater for free. And so I saw every movie at the local art house movie theater for a couple years. And I saw some weird movies, including The City of Lost Children.
Like, I know you were super grossed out by most of the vampire effects, but compared to the first movie, especially, like, the giant vampire in that and the blood monster stuff at the end of that was all so weird looking and bad. And this, like, aside, like, the CG in the fights is really bad, but the practical gore effects of, like, when they're cutting open one of the super vampires that they capture, and when they chop that guy's head in half, like, all of that stuff, it looked really, really solid. Like, some very gory, but also very believable practical effects going on.
The movie I couldn't think of the name of is Delicatessen, which is 1991, directed by Marc Caro and Jean-Pierre Jeunet. Anyway, Ron Perlman's not in it, as it turns out.
Oh.
Yeah. So,
you know what he is in? Fun fact. Hellboy.
He is in Hellboy.
Guillermo del Toro.
Yes, which I like Hellboy. Is that a Marvel movie? Are we going to watch that?
No, I think it's like, I can't remember who owns it, but it's definitely not Marvel.
The character isn't?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else to say about this movie?
The last movie we watched, the first X-Men movie, had a connection to the Metal Gear Solid series in that the final script was written by David Hayter, who voices Solid Snake, and this movie has a connection to the Metal Gear Solid series in that Hideo Kojima, the director of that series, is good friends and collaborator with both Norman Reedus and Guillermo del Toro, currently.
Okay. I like that. Now, I feel like I want to have a thing like that to say. So I will say Danny John Jules, who plays Assad in this, and as we mentioned earlier, plays Officer Dwayne Myers in Death in Paradise. Death in Paradise, until recently, starred Chris Marshall, who is rumored to be the next Doctor. I don't like that casting, and I recapped Doctor Who.
Cool.
Connection. It's the same as how you did it.
That did remind me of something else that I did like about, like, in the first movie, it seems like Blade is the only one who has sort of golden eyes, and in this one, seemed like all of the vampires did, but I thought they looked really good. Like, as far as I'm assuming it was contact, because CG would have been, you know, a pretty tall ask for all of those characters having CG eyes, but I thought the gold contacts looked really solid. Like, usually when people wear colored contacts, there's something fucked up with the pupils where they get misaligned and starts looking really weird. Like, that's what really bothered me about Superman Returns, is they gave Brandon Routh blue eyes with the contacts, but like in a lot of the close-ups, the pupils would be off center and it would just be really distracting. It was also a big problem in the Dune TV series.
I feel like it was a problem in this movie that you're giving a compliment to.
You noticed the pupils were messed up?
With Blade only. I was noticing through the whole thing how everybody had cuckoo contacts, except for Nyssa. She had her normal brown eyes, and it was awesome. I felt like it was so nice not to be distracted by looking at her eyes. But everybody else who had the colored contacts, I was like, okay, well, you know, that's obviously contacts, but it looks cool. Except Blade, his always looked askew to me.
Well, I wonder if Wesley Snipes just has a lazy eye.
Maybe.
Maybe that's why he always has the sunglasses on. Maybe that's like the origin of that character trait.
Oh, and they're like, it's okay if they're teeny tiny sunglasses because we only need to cover up his eyes. And also, fashion from this era. Mm-hmm. Apparently, no matter how big your head is, no matter how big and tough you're supposed to be, your sunglasses are supposed to be so petite. So petite.
And now he gets free Oakleys for life.
Is that real?
I believe that's true. No, I might be thinking of Cyclops from the X-Men movie.
James Marsden?
Yeah.
Oh, I would like that better.
Because in the first Blade, he has black flies for his iconic shades. But in this movie, every pair of sunglasses is a variation of Oakleys.
You know, what I appreciate is that you noticed that there was more than one pair.
I mean, I noticed that every single person was wearing a pair.
Here's another thing about Danny John Jules. Did you know that he appeared in 67 episodes of Red Dwarf?
No, I've never seen that show.
No, but it's a thing that geeks are interested in.
I also don't even remember how he died in this movie.
He and Nyssa waded into a pool full of skeletons. Right.
The skeleton pile.
Just looking around the top of the room. And then all of the Reaper vampires were like piranhas on him. What was that like? Oh my gosh. Finnick O'Day. It's like that scene from the Hunger Games final movie where Finnick is in a pool of piranhas or something like that.
I never saw the last one.
Anyway, it was exactly like any pool of piranhas inside of a sewer that you've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, I think pool of piranhas was evocative enough.
But I mean, like, specific to in a sewer. In an underground sewer.
Oh, there's a sewer of piranhas in that movie?
Yeah, Finnick O'Day gets eaten by piranhas in a sewer of... I mean, or something like that, you know. Could be crocodile people. Maybe it's crocodile people. I wonder if it was the Hunger Games. I think it was.
I mean, if you're saying Finnick, then that's that movie.
You know, but you know how I name people things, like Stands with a Fist. And
right, but you know, I mean, how many movies have you seen that guy one time?
He's kind of a generic-looking white heartthrob. I could have seen him in a lot of stuff. No offense to him, but there you go.
Blade fights the vampire dude Namek in the laboratory and breaks his sword and finally wedges it through the one weak spot that will reach his heart. And then he goes and cradles his almost-girlfriend vampire and takes her out to die in the sunlight because she got bit by her pseudo-brother super vampire. And once again, Blade is alone, left to wander the earth with his old man best friend.
That dusty dusting of that lady in the sunshine reminded me of The Mummy, like the Brendan Fraser one, which I'm halfway through rewatching right now, because Every negative thing I've seen online about the new Tom Cruise one made me want to rewatch the original, and then it was on TV today. And so more than once during this movie when vampires were dusting in the sunshine, I thought, oh, I want to finish watching The Mummy. I feel like we're forcing it at this point.
Yeah, I kind of suspected this would be like a shorter episode in general, both because the plot is so much more basic than anything we've watched so far, and there just wasn't a lot of cool shit about it to talk about. One of the guys has a big hammer. He also, like, that's the disappointing thing. The difference between this and Alien is, like, Alien, it's like, oh, here, or Aliens, here's this crack squad of misfits. Same with, like, Predator, you know? You get more of a sense of their who these characters are and what their specialties are, and maybe they even get a chance to show off here and there before the monsters start killing them. But in this, it's like the monsters are so completely immune to anything they can do that they all just start getting killed immediately, and then it's like, you know, I guess we'll go back to the drawing board and come back with flashlights, and everyone will still die.
I appreciate that there's a lot of geek culture crossover in this film. So there's Norman Reedus, who is Walking Dead. There's
Ron Perlman.
I wasn't going to say Ron Perlman, but I mean, we can say him. What would you put, what would you say that he's been in that is really geek culture?
Hellboy, Pacific Rim.
Yeah, I knew there was something.
I'm sure there's other stuff that I'm not thinking of.
I was trying to think of...
I don't even know what...
I kept wanting to say Danny John Jules.
Man, what other characters even are there?
No, Donnie Yen is from Rogue One. And then I feel like this guy, Paul Casey, who plays a blood bank guard, plays a Nazi all the time. Oh, he's in Rogue One, too. He must be a Nazi in that. And he's in a lot of Doctor Who. Oh, he's Ood Sigma. Huh. So that guy, he gets a lot of geek work. I don't know what I was thinking. I felt like there was a third person who had some cred.
It's hard to think of a third person who was in this movie. Kris Kristofferson?
Well, he's in A Star Is Born, and you know how the geek culture loves that film. Especially
and,
the one he's in.
Heaven's Gate.
Mm-hmm.
Nerds are huge fans of that.
Right.
As well as the first Blade.
Mm-hmm. All right. I don't think I have anything else to say about this movie.
I think we'll close out with, do you want to know what Norman Reedus' son's name is?
No, but I would like to see a baby picture of Norman Reedus to find out if he has that hair and the bags under his eyes since birth. Yes, I do want to know his son's name. What is it?
Mingus.
Mingus?
Mingus Reedus.
Oh, dear.
We'll see you next time, where we will be watching Spider-Man for real this time.
I thought you were going to say X2. That's what I want to watch.
I mean, we'll get there soon enough, but I mean, Spider-Man's... finally, like, a pretty solid movie.
I am looking forward to when we can start watching the good ones.
We're not there yet. I mean, we're going to have a nice little upslope here with Spider-Man and X2, but we're going to be hitting Daredevil and Blade Trinity before you know it. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye, thank you.